This is Spectator Radio, the Spectator's curated podcast collection.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. My name is John Connolly, and I'm joined today by Katie Balls and the New Statesman's Stephen Bush. Now, this week we're expecting to see a spectacle of violence, backstabbing and Machiavellian plots to take power. No, it's not the new season of Game of Thrones. It's the continuing Tory party leadership contest. Theresa May is away this week and Parliament is recessed, but the contest shows no sign of stepping down. Katie, who have we seen make their pitch this morning?
So there's various leadership contenders who are doing lots of things on what is supposed to be a quiet recess week. I think to just set the scene, we have one story today is ministers in the cabinet putting out the message that they don't want a Tory leadership contest before the summer, because if you have one before the summer, they believe that will benefit people like Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab, Brexiteers who say they want to renegotiate the withdrawal agreement and potentially would countenance a no-deal Brexit. So they want to play for time, and for that reason are happy for Theresa May to stay in place rather than be an immediate move against her. There was some speculation when we entered this longer extension that it might give the MPs the chance to have that leadership contest, but you're already seeing some concern that given that it might not play out as they want, they might not want to do it. Now, that doesn't mean that the ministers who don't want an immediate leadership contest aren't parading. We have had Sajid Javid today give a speech talking about crime and how he wants to be tough on the causes of crime. He's talking about also his vision for society. Jeremy Hunt is in Japan and has been doing much broadcast. And then I think you can look at Boris Johnson's piece in the Telegraph today, where he really seems to be trying to set out his pitch for One Nation conservatism. Now, One Nation conservatism seems to be what I think nearly every candidate thinks that they represent. And it's what Amber Rudd, who we don't expect to run, but is seen as an important endorsement to get, potentially a kingmaker. She has a caucus, which, you know, is the One Nation Tories. So it's interesting that you're seeing Brexiteers try and move in on that, because there's plenty of Tory MPs who probably veer towards a softer Brexit, who often point to members of the European Research Group as being much more divisive. So that is the pitch he is trying to get across.
Are we being quite cynical in sort of seeing a speech by Sajid Javid on crime as a leadership pitch?
I mean, I don't think we are, because the slightly surreal thing about that speech, right, and someone who basically broadly agreed with the policy argument being put forward, right, is to hear a politician talking about how on knife crime you need to learn from what Glasgow has done, treat it as a public health issue, with any other cabinet minister, you'd go, okay, yeah, fine, fair enough. It's slightly surreal hearing the literal Secretary of State for the Home Department going, hey, I've got some thoughts about how we should deal with knife crime. It's like, I mean, don't you have the ability to have things other than thoughts? So I think in that context, of course, it's fine to see it as a leadership tilt, because if it was a serious policy contribution, then he would be announcing policies, because that's a thing that as the relevant Secretary of State, he can do.
Meanwhile, talks are ongoing between the Labour and Conservative parties to try and sort of break the Brexit impasse. How do you think they're going?
Well, they're slightly strange because these talks have been going on for several weeks now. Now, Theresa May is in Wales walking. It's not like she is in the room for these. And you don't really get the impression at any point that these are down to the wire, everyone's staying late, working hard to reach some kind of agreement, some cross-party consensus that they can put to a vote imminently. It feels as though both sides are quite happy to be seen to be having these talks, to be seen to being cooperative, but we're quite far away from a real breakthrough. And this week, I think it's being broken down to working groups, and they're looking at things such as workers' rights, but there's no mention really of the big issue, the customs union, which is the issue that something, if the Tories were willing to move and say, we want to put a permanent customs union in the political declaration, that could be what would unlock an area or some form of deal both sides could agree on.
I don't know. So I think the slight weirdness about these talks, right, is there is a political cost to walking out of them and going, I'm not going to come to terms. But I'm not convinced there is actually a position that either side can get to that can command a majority in the House, right? So like, let's talk about, say, a customs union. Still a pretty hard form of Brexit in terms of what it does to our trade with the EU. Also, paradoxically, quite a pointless form of Brexit because you can't strike your own trade deals. However, that is probably as soft as you can get without losing even more Conservative votes than the withdrawal agreement had anyway. It's not certain that without a second referendum you could get enough Labour MPs to vote for it. And I can't see why, if you're Jeremy Corbyn, you have a political interest in signing up to a pretty hard version of Brexit without a second referendum that allows you to be outflanked by the SNP, Plaid Cymru, TIG, etc., etc. Theresa May obviously can't get any softer than that. He can't get any harder than that. So presumably we will just have this weird situation where the talks are nominally happening, but are never actually going to progress.
And I think there's also this element, which is neither side wants to be the first to walk away, because then you look as though you are the side that is being difficult, that doesn't want to put party politics aside for the good of the country, for delivering Brexit. So you do get the sense these talks could be going, you know, 2 weeks to go to the extension runs out, talks are constructive, says number 10 spokesperson. I think there is still a chance that we will get some form of vote. And if you talk to figures in government, they think early May, Theresa May does want to hold a series of votes on what is happening with this Brexit deal. And if at that point you can't reach any consensus on a new withdrawal agreement, a new political declaration to put alongside the withdrawal agreement and to have that voted on, then what you could do is have indicative votes that this time are actually binding. So you would have a couple of options and you would see if any of those got majority, such as a permanent customs union or a second referendum. But I still think there isn't a great hope that any of those options would really wield majority. So it could be just to show that you're reaching out. It's definitely the case that in number 10, they would really like to avoid these European elections. They don't want to be fielding candidates. All the polls so far show that this looks like it's going to be very disastrous for the Tories. And there is this feeling that if they could get a deal over the line and stop that from happening, that would be a great thing. I do think the actual hope that they are able to do that, though, is fading fast. And I think even the most optimistic number 10 aides are very doubtful that they'll be able to get a deal over the line before the European elections.
And do you think that, Stephen, the European election polling, which is showing, you know, Labour moving ahead or staying in the same place and the Conservatives dropping, has dropped the pressure on them to make an effort in the cross-party talks as well?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, so the indication so far from all the polling you have is it's a bit of a plague on everyone's houses and voters are defecting to the kind of parties of the various Brexit extremes, as it were. But ultimately, the contest which matters is first past the post. It doesn't really matter, other than for Jeremy Corbyn's ego, if he's first on 32% or first on 42%. So the fact that it seems like this position in Brexit hurts the Conservatives more than Labour does change the incentives. If the country was crying out for Jeremy Corbyn to make some kind of deal, and all of the pressure was, oh, why is he blocking it? Why is it? Then, of course, you can see how a deal would be done. I think one of the big things going to happen is that until relatively recently, I think if we'd done this even last week, I think we'd all have gone, well, there's a decentish chance that there will be an election. If, as looks quite likely, the Conservative Party gets shellacked in the local elections and shellacked in the European elections, this idea that the Conservative Prime Minister is going to stand up and go, do you know what I'd really like if those jobs which were lost weren't some councillors or some people we had to dragoon in from CCSU? I am fascinated to who the Conservative MEP candidates are going to be, right? Because if you're a Lib Dem, right, it doesn't matter if you win or lose. You've done something for the party that's popular. Ditto if you're a Labour MEP candidate, you've done. Whereas if you're a Conservative MEP candidate, it's not like a local association's going to look favourably on your time wandering around the country being defeated by the Brexit Party. You've just got this huge blot on your CV that gives you absolutely nothing.
John, you were at the Brexit Party launch on Friday. What was the mood there?
So the mood from Nigel Farage was definitely they're going to capitalise on this massive disillusionment with Westminster at the moment over the Brexit talks. I could see that being a very effective message. It's very potent. Your MPs have betrayed you. If you're angry, vote for us, which I think will work. It was very striking the amount of people I spoke to there who were sort of attendees and either supporters or considering supporting the new Brexit Party, was how many of them had links to the Tory party specifically. They'd either been involved in their local associations, had been Tory voters all their lives. Some had sort of come through UKIP, but had actually come back to the Tory party in 2016 with sort of Theresa May's pitch toward them, but now felt completely and utterly sort of betrayed. And a lot of their anger was, I think, at the Conservatives, not just because they're sort of running the Brexit negotiations at the moment, but also because they felt that their manifesto in 2017, they'd completely betrayed it. And the fact that we'd not left on the 29th of March sort of added to that more.
And it's definitely the case that the media attention the Brexit Party's been getting, and also just the number of people turning out for the various events they're holding, is unsettling a lot of Tory MPs. I think they are nervous about it because they can sense the anger. And as you were saying to me, John, earlier, lots of the people who are going to this launch, they are former Tory voters. So that is draining the Tories of support. So it's definitely a cause of unease.
So the Labour Party also suffered a bit of a blow over the weekend after the Sunday Times released a tape of Jeremy Corbyn talking with Margaret Hodge about evidence of anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. It's a sort of story we've seen over the past year. What impact do you think these fresh allegations and continuing stories of anti-Semitism are having on the Labour Party, Stephen?
Well, so I think in terms of their immediate political impact, right, the grim truth is that voters of any majority cannot be relied upon to change their votes in the interests of a minority. And so the only cost to Labour directly is every time that we talk about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, they're not talking about, you know, their plan for schools or hospitals or nationalisation or something that's actually popular. So it's an opportunity cost rather than a direct political cost. However, what all of these stories are the kind of trailer for the feature film of is what happens when the EHRC completes its investigation into the Labour Party and either says, we think that there is something that needs a full-blown investigation from us, or, which I mean, to be honest, feels highly unlikely, but let's just acknowledge the pot, or they say, actually, it's all fine. When the EHRC finishes its report, for a lot of Labour MPs, particularly because now the polls once again look quite favourable for Labour, that kind of stress point of, are you willing to put this guy into Downing Street? Maybe you ought to consider TIG. Maybe you ought to do something, you know, ought to set up your own enterprise, becomes so much harder to ignore. And I think in an odd way, the weird consequence of TIG breaking away is the polls got so much worse for Labour than a bunch of Labour MPs who were going, oh God, can I make him Prime Minister? Were suddenly going, oh, well, the country's not going to make him Prime Minister anyway. That things have got so much worse for the Tories again, and that anti-Semitism is back in the news, means that for a certain type of Labour MP, their anxieties about that issue are no longer things that they can go, oh, the electorate will sort it out for me.
And do you think we have a few MPs who are sort of on the cusp of defection, or is that difficult to say?
One Labour MP put it well, and they compared it ironically to joining ISIS, right? So you've got indices of radicalisation, right? And with ISIS, it's, you know, deprivation, poor education, access to radical preaching. And with Labour MPs thinking of leaving the Labour Party, it's concern over anti-Semitism, opposition to the Brexit policy, and fear of being deselected locally. So far, of the eight Labour MPs to join TIG, they've all ticked all of those boxes. And if you look at people who tick all of those boxes, actually there are very few Labour MPs who are concerned about anti-Semitism, opposed to the Brexit policy, and under pressure from their CLPs. The danger point for Labour, I think, is if you start to see people in those concerned about anti-Semitism, concerned about Brexit, not under pressure in their local parties. And those people notionally could at any point go, actually, I can't defend this anymore. So they are always nominally at risk. But so far, I don't think there's anyone who's actually going to make that leap.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening. And in case you missed it, we have a current offer at the moment, which is 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, plus £20 of John Lewis vouchers. If you want to access the offer, all you have to do is go to www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.